but echo, caught from a soundless voice, wrote Mark Strand. It is with great pleasure that I introduce our honored guest of the evening, poet Mark Strand.
Hear me? I want to thank Blue Metropolis and Concordia for asking me to come. And I didn't see the book out there, but I'm going to read some poems from books that I've written, the three recent books, and I'll read some new poems as well. And I should flash the book so you know which one to buy if you like the poem. The idea. For us too, there was a wish to possess something beyond the world we knew, beyond ourselves, beyond our power to imagine, something nevertheless in which we might see ourselves. And this desire came always in passing, in waning light, and in such cold that ice on the valley's lakes cracked and rolled, and blowing snow covered what earth we saw, and scenes from the past, when they surfaced again, looked not as they had, but ghostly and white among false curves and hidden erasures. And never once did we feel we were close until the night wind said, "Why do this, especially now? Go back to the place you belong." And there appeared with its windows glowing, small, in the distance, in the frozen reaches, a cabin. And we stood before it, amazed at its being there, and would have gone forward and opened the door and stepped into the glow and warmed ourselves there, but that it was ours by not being ours and should remain empty. That was the idea. There's a poem by Apollinaire called Toujours, in which he speculates on who the first man to forget a continent will be. This is my response to that poem. It's called Always. Always so late in the day, in their rumpled clothes, sitting around a table lit by a single bulb, the great forgetters were hard at work. They tilted their heads to one side, closing their eyes. Then a house disappeared, and a man in his yard with all his flowers in a row. The great forgetters wrinkled their brows. Then Florida went, and San Francisco, where tugs and barges leave small gleaming scars across the bay. One of the great forgetters struck a match. Gone were the harps of beaded lights that vault the rivers of New York. Another filled his glass, and that was it for crowds at evening under sulfur yellow street lamps coming on. And afterwards, Bulgaria was gone, and then Japan. "Where will it stop?" one of them said. "Such difficult work, pursuing the fate of everything known," said another. "Down to the last stone," said a third, "and only the cold zero of perfection left for the imagination." And gone were North and South America, and gone as well the moon. One of the great forgetters coughed, another yawned, another gazed at the window. No grass, no trees, the blaze of promise everywhere. I'll read some new poems. I am not thinking of death, but death is thinking of me. He leans back in his chair, rubs his hands, strokes his beard, and says, I'm thinking of Strand. I'm thinking that one of these days I'll be out back swinging my scythe or holding my hourglass up to the moon, and Strand will appear in a jacket and tie, and together under the boulevard's leafless trees we'll stroll into the city of souls. And when we get to the great piazza with its marble mansions, the crowd that had been waiting there will welcome us with delirious cries, and their tears, turned hard and cold as glass from having been held back so long, will fall and clatter on the stones below. Oh, let it be soon. Let it be soon. Man and Camel. On the eve of my 40th birthday, I sat on the porch having a smoke, when out of the blue, a man and a camel happened by. Neither uttered a sound at first, but as they drifted up the street and out of town, the two of them began to sing. Yet what they sang is still a mystery to me. The words were indistinct, and the tune too ornamental to recall. Into the desert they went, and as they went, their voices rose as one above the sifting sound of wind-blown sand. The wonder of their singing, its elusive blend of man and camel, seemed an ideal image for all uncommon couples. Was this the night that I had waited for so long? I wanted to believe it was, but just as they were vanishing, the man and camel ceased to sing and galloped back to town. They stood before my porch, staring up at me with beady eyes, and said, "You ruined it. You ruined it forever." Mother and son. After man and camel, where do you go? The son enters the mother's room and stands by the bed where the mother lies. The son believes that she wants to tell him what he longs to hear, that he is her boy, always her boy. The son leans down to kiss the mother's lips, but her lips are cold. The burial of feelings has begun. The son touches the mother's hands one last time, then turns and sees the moon's full face. An ashen light falls across the floor. If the moon could speak, what would it say? If the moon could speak, it would say nothing. elevator. It's in two parts. Part one. The elevator went to the basement. The doors opened. A man stepped in and asked if I was going up. I'm going down, I said. I won't be going up. Two. The elevator went to the basement. The doors opened. A man stepped in and asked if I was going up. I'm going down, I said. I won't be going up. As far as I know, nobody's done that. It didn't take very long to write that poem. This is called Cake. A man leaves for the next town to pick up a cake. On the way, he gets lost in a dense woods, and the cake is never picked up. Years later, the man appears on a beach, staring at the sea. I'm standing on a beach, he thinks, and I am lost in thought. He does not move. The heaving sea turns black. Its waves curl and crash. Soon I will leave, he continues. Soon I will go to a nearby town to pick up a cake. I will walk in a brown and endless woods, and far away the heaving sea will turn to black, and the waves, I can see them now, will curl and crash. Let's see. 2032. It is evening in the town of X, where Death, who used to love me, sits in a limo with a blanket spread across his thighs, waiting for his driver to appear. His hair is white. His eyes have gotten small. His cheeks have lost their luster. He has not swung his scythe in years or touched his hourglass. He is waiting to be driven to the Blue Hotel, the ultimate resort, where an endless silence fills the lilac-scented air and marble fish swim motionless in marble seas, and where is his driver? Ah, there she is, coming down the garden steps in heels, velvet evening gown and golden boa blowing kisses to the trees. Now, I'll read it. I'll go back to some, at least one more recent poem, but maybe two, but I'll read a couple of poems from this book. If dawn breaks the heart and the moon is a horror and the sun is nothing but the source of torpor, then of course I would have been silent all these years and would not have chosen to go out tonight in my new dark blue double-breasted suit and to sit in a restaurant with a bowl of soup before me to celebrate how good life has been and how it has culminated in this instant. The harmonies of wholesomeness have reached their apogee and I am a quiver with satisfaction, and you look good too. I love your gold teeth and your dyed hair, a little green, a little yellow, and your weight, which is finally up where we never thought it would be. Oh, my partner, my beautiful death, my black paradise, my fusty intoxicant, my symbolist muse, give me your breast, or your hand, or your tongue that sleeps all day behind its wall of reddish gums. Lay yourself down on the restaurant floor and recite all that's been kept from my happiness. Tell me I have not lived in vain, that the stars will not die, that things will stay as they are, that what I have seen will last, that I was not born into change, that what I have said has not been said for me. It happened years ago, and in somebody else's dining room. Madame X begged to be relieved of a sexual pain that had my name written all over it. Those were the days when so many things of a sexual nature seemed to happen, and my name, I believed, was written on all of them. Madame X took my hand under the table, placed it on her thigh, then moved it up. You would never know what a woman with such blue eyes and blonde hair was not wearing. Did I suffer knowing that I was wanted for the wrong reasons? Of course. And it has taken me years to recover. We don't give parties like that anymore. These days we sit around and sigh. We like the sound of it, and it seems to combine weariness and judgment. Even to suggest no eggs for the moment, no sausages either. Just come, take me away, and put me to bed. I mentioned two poems in this poem. One is a poem by Jules Laforgue called The Lament of the Pianos Heard in Rich Neighborhoods, and the other is a poem of Wallace Stevens called Piano Practice at the Academy of the Holy Angels. All afternoon I have thought, how alike are the lament of the pianos heard in rich neighborhoods and piano practice at the Academy of the Holy Angels, and how the girls that played are no longer here. Yet it was never a vast music that mingled with the lusters of the room, nothing that would drown our desire for rest or silence. It was just there, like the source of delight, unblemished, unobserved, though things did not always turn out well. As now the green leaves brood under an early snow, and the houses are darkened by time. The sounds of summer have left. The purple woods which color the distance form a farewell for the monotonous autumn. The snows have come, and the black shapes of the pianos are sleeping and cannot be roused, like the girls themselves who have gone, and the leaves and all that was just here. Some last words. I'm not finished yet, but it's the title of this poem. It's in seven very short sections. One, it is easier for a needle to pass through a camel than for a poor man to enter a woman of means. Just go to the graveyard and ask around. Two, Eventually, you slip outside, letting the door bang shut on your latest thought. What was it anyway? Just go to the graveyard and ask around. 3. Negligence is the perfume I love. Oh, Fedora, Fedora, if you want any, just go to the graveyard and ask around. 4. The bones of the buffalo, the rabbit at sunset, the wind and its double, the tree, the town. Just go to the graveyard and ask around. 5. If you think good things are on their way and the world will improve, don't hold your breath. Just go to the graveyard and ask around. 6. You over there, why do you ask if this is the Valley of Limitless Blue and if we are its prisoners? Just go to the graveyard and ask around. 7. Life is a dream that is never recalled when the sleeper awakes. If this is beyond you, magnificent one, just go to the graveyard and ask around. I'll read this for Eva, who introduced me, because she is a lover of the work of Joseph Brodsky, who is a friend of mine, and this is a poem in memory of Joseph Brodsky. It could be said, even here, that what remains of the self unwinds into a vanishing light and thins like dust and heads to a place where knowing and nothing pass into each other and through, that moves, unwinding still, beyond the vault of brightness ended, and continues to a place which may never be found, where the unsayable finally once more is uttered, but lightly, quickly, like random rain that passes in sleep, that one imagines passes in sleep. What remains of the self unwinds and unwinds, for none of the boundaries holds, neither the shapeless one between us, nor the one that falls between your body and your voice. Joseph, dear Joseph, those sudden reminders of your having been, the places and times whose greatest life was the one you gave them, now appear like ghosts in your wake. What remains of the self unwinds beyond us, for whom time is only a measure of meanwhile, and the future no more than etc., etc., but fast and forever. I read a recent poem which was a commission. I was asked by the Brentano Quartet. I'd done something else with them in the past, and it seemed to work out. And we got along very well, and they're a very good young quartet, and they play everywhere. And they asked me, they conceived of a program of Webern, 3 Webern quartets and Mozart, and they wanted me to write a few lines to go between each of the movements of the Webern quartets. Some of the movements are very short. I mean, a minute, minute and a half. One is even less than a minute. And some, I think the longest is about 3.5 minutes. But, and I started listening to the Webern, and I started, you know, dreamily, it's intensely romantic and intensely abstract. And it struck me as very profound, but its profundity was something that I sensed. I couldn't describe it. I dreamily began writing a little, and pretty soon I had, you know, a few lines here, a few lines there, and then I would go back and listen to the music and in the hopes that I would get more. But I would go back to the music and get less. Not that the music was any less, but that whatever charge I experienced at the beginning, I wasn't experiencing again. And so I decided to forget the music and just to write this poem, which I'm going to read, and which I will read between the movements of the Webern Quartet when that concert when that concert happens in February. But I'm just going to pause between each of these four-line sections. I've called it, for want of a better title, The Webern Variations. The sudden rush of it, pushing aside the branches, late summer flashing towards the image of its absence. Into the heart of nothing, into the radiant hollows, even the language of vanishing leaves itself behind. Clouds, trees, houses, in the feeling they awaken as the dark approaches seem like pieces of another life. One can sift through what remains, the dust of phrases uttered once, the ruins of a passion. It comes to less each time. The voice sliding down, the voice turning round and lengthening the thread of sense, the thread of sound. Those avenues of light that slid between the clouds moments ago are gone, and suddenly it is dark. Who will be left to stitch and sew the shroud of song? The houses back in place, the trees rising from a purple shade. Not too late to see oneself walk the beach at night. How easily the sea comes in, spreads, retreats, and disappears. How easily it breathes, and the late risen half moon, drawn out of darkness, staring down, seems to pause above the waves. Under the moon and stars, which are what they have always been, what should we be but ourselves in this light, which is no light to speak of? What should we hear but the voice that would be ours, shaping itself, the secret voice of being, telling us that where we disappear is where we are? What to make of a season's end, the drift of cold drawn down the hallways of the night, the wind pushing aside the leaves. The vision of one's passing passes. Days flow into other days. The voice that sews and stitches again picks up its work. And everything turns and turns, and the unknown turns into the song that is the known. But what in turn becomes of the song is not for us to say. Well, I haven't read this poem yet. But, I mean, I read it because I wrote it, but I haven't, read it out loud. At least not in this shape. It's called Mirror. A white room and a party going on. And I was standing with some friends under a large gilt-framed mirror that tilted slightly forward over the fireplace. We were drinking whiskey, and some of us, feeling no pain, were trying to decide what precise shade of yellow the setting sun turned our drinks. I closed my eyes briefly, then looked up into the mirror. A woman in a green dress leaned against the far wall. She seemed distracted. The fingers of one hand fidgeted with her necklace, and she was staring into the mirror, not at me, but past me, into a space that might be filled by someone yet to arrive, who at that moment could be starting the journey which would lead eventually to her. Then suddenly my friends said it was time to move on to the next party. This was years ago, and though I have forgotten where we went and who we all were, I still recall that moment of looking up and seeing the woman stare past me into a place I could only imagine. And each time it is with a pang, as if just then I were stepping from the depths of the mirror into that white room, breathless and eager, only to discover too late that she is not there. I read one last poem. I think that's about the right time, right? Then I'll answer questions. This poem is appropriately called The End. It comes at the end of a book, too. This one. Not everyone knows what he shall sing at the end, watching the pier as the ship sails away, or what it will seem like when he's held by the sea's roar, motionless there at the end, or what he shall hope for once it is clear that he'll never go back. When the time has passed to prune the rose or caress the cat, when the sunset torching the lawn and the full moon icing it down no longer appear, not everyone knows what he'll discover instead. When the weight of the past leans against nothing, and the sky is no more than remembered light, and the stories of cirrus and cumulus come to a close, and all the birds are suspended in flight, not everyone knows what is waiting for him, or what he shall sing when the ship he is on slips into darkness there at the end. Thank you.
On behalf of Concordia's Department of English and the Blue Metropolis Theater Series, I would like to thank Mark Strand for an extraordinary evening. It's truly been a pleasure to have you here in Montreal, and that you were staying longer, but we're glad that you're not leaving yet. There will be time for some questions from you, and I also want to remind you as well to purchase books. You know which ones to buy, and come and get them signed afterwards. But Mr. Strand has kindly agreed to take some questions from the audience. So, are there any questions? Maybe we could have the lights up. So that,
ta-da! Are they up?
They're starting. There they are. They're coming up. Any first question?
Yeah.
Yes.
I lived there for 6 weeks. My parents went to Halifax for a year and then came to Montreal. And I was in Canada for the first 4.5 years of my life. and then move with my parents. Well, how else would I move at 4 and a half to Philadelphia? But I spent a lot of summers before I was 13 years old on St. Margaret's Bay, outside of Halifax, and different towns, in French Village, Seabright, Glen Margaret, Hackett's Cove. So the landscape of that shore, the eastern shore, I used as decor in a lot of my poems. I actually wrote some of my poems. There are a few of the poems at the back of my selected poems, which came out in 1980. There are some poems that are set in Nova Scotia that are more than mere, Nova Scotia is more than just the background. And there's a poem in there, Shooting Whales, a very unpopular thing to admit to having done now, but in those days it was a necessity, I suppose. I mean, I was a kid, what did I know? But yeah, I mean, my PEI experience is very limited. Yeah, way back there. Well, I studied painting, and I did graphs and some monoprints, but it's not a career, and it's not even I've ceased doing it. What I do now is I have these canvases, and I write poems on canvases from the rough draft with all the crossing out and with doodles all the way to the final version. So I'm going to have a show of those. That's going to be my retirement money. I'm going to make $1 million and go back to Nova Scotia and pretend I'm 5 years old again. Yes?
Mr. Strand, when did you know that you were a poet?
Oh, when did I know I was a poet? It's still a question. I still hope I'm a poet. You know, I think I said to this morning in the master class I was talking, I sort of woke up at 40 and there was no turning back. I mean, this is what I'd been doing. And I figured this is what I'm stuck with. Not a bad way to be stuck, since I enjoy the problem of solving poems. But, you know, at the beginning, I didn't know. And, you know, if a lot of people say, hey, you're terrific at this, you know, you should keep doing it, you say, it's a good idea. I mean, because I don't know if somebody else is telling. You know, when you're young, you believe what other people tell you. If they say you're dope, you go around depressed thinking you're a dope. If they say you're a genius, you become arrogant and you think you're smarter than anybody else. So people said, you know, you should keep writing. So. But I had my doubts, you know. You always, just people who are very certain about what they're doing become monstrous. You know, if they're too sure, too certain, they become monstrous. You don't want to be around those people. They make you feel insignificant. You know. They make you feel that genetically something's missing in your makeup. You know? Yeah.
Would you say that winning the Pulitzer changed your work?
That what?
Winning the Pulitzer.
Did it change my work? No. No, I mean, my work changes from book to book. I mean, winning a prize doesn't change your work. It makes you feel good. I mean, for 10 minutes, 15 minutes or so. And then, you know, you're back to yourself again. The same old self. The one that has to get up and eat breakfast, drink coffee, work on another poem. You know, prizes are always, they seem more valuable when you're not winning them. When you're winning them, I don't seem to be that. It doesn't do enough for you. You know, it's not that you want more prizes. I wish it had changed my life. I mean, that's what you sort of want, something to change your life. I mean, if your life, if you're not happy with your life. I mean, I'm fairly happy with my life until a better life comes along, you know. I mean, show me a better one and I'll jump into it. Yeah. How has my writing influenced the writing of others? I don't know. You know, I just... when I was younger, my first couple books were somewhat influential and I had a lot of imitators. And I didn't think they were any good, I thought. But then they got to be better. I mean, I think they wrote my poems better than I wrote my poems. So I had to make these shifts. Now, I don't read that much poetry, you know, what younger people are doing, because you generally look at the generation ahead of you. You know, I was looking at Merwin and Merrill and, you know, people like that, because I wanted to be like them. But, you know, you don't look back, unless you're teaching creative writing, then you see what's coming up. I edited the Best American Poetry of 1991. So I got a view of what American poets were doing. I didn't think anyone was influenced by me, but then I could be wrong. I think a lot of, you know, it's hard. You know, I mean, there's such a difference between Ashbery and the people who think they're writing like Ashbery. It's just, and James Merrill is inimitable. I mean, nobody's that skilled. It's just, the skill factor is so great that, you know, he sort of priced his way out of the sort of imitation market. But no, I just don't know. Yeah.
When does your best inspiration come out? In the evening or in the daytime or you go other places? When is the best time that it makes you, I'm going to write this?
The question was, when does my best inspiration come? Yeah. When does that moment come when I say, I'm going to write this, right? I think it comes early in the morning when I get up. I the first thing I do is make coffee, and I sit there in my, you know, pajamas, and or sometimes if it's warm, I don't wear pajamas, and I write that for an hour and a half, and then I go and do other things, and then circle back later in the day to see what I've done. But I'm freshest in the morning.
Have you ever awoken in the night and said, I got to get up and write?
I have. And it's been terrible. I look at it the next day and I said, it wasn't worth it. It's just, this is a mess. I'm never going to make anything out of this. Yeah, Linda.
Do you enjoy translating other poets' work?
No. I hate translation. The question was, do I enjoy translating the work of others? I did it as a kind of duty. I mean, a cultural duty. I thought that I would be a participant in the bringing of other writers into English. And it was also a way in which I thought I might improve my own writing, because a lot of the problems you face translating are problems that you take for granted in your own work. I think I talked about this morning. I don't know how to translate anymore. I don't know what a poem should anybody else's poem should sound like. I feel if they sound too much like my poem, I haven't done a good job. My poetry, I haven't done a good job. You know, but I feel, if they don't sound enough like my poetry, I'm going to look foolish. I'm going to look like a terrible translator, like somebody who doesn't know English. You know, so I mean, there are super. Richard Wilbur is a terrific translator, and Merwin is a terrific. There are some poets who are just so gifted at translating. I'm not one of them, and I did. You know, I translated a few books. And then I said, the hell with it. It's going to drive me nuts. So, yes?
What advice would you give to young poets?
I would say read. What advice would I give to young poets? I had a teacher once who said, Strand, keep your mouth shut and your eyes and your ears open. I think that's good advice. And I was also encouraged to read a great deal. If you don't read, you can't write. I mean, you're lost. You might be able to crank one book out, but then you're going to run out of gas. Reading feeds you. I mean, reading is a writer's diet. There are people who don't read and want to write. I don't understand that. I mean, where did they get the idea to write? You know, why do they want to write? They want to write books that they wouldn't read? But the people who don't read and write only want to read their poems out loud. Others. Somebody back there, yeah. The influences on me, other influential poets. I don't, you know, I really don't know. I mean, I think a lot. Ashbery's everybody's, you know. I mean, he's a very influential poet. There are other poets who, I mean, poets. I'm not a fan of, but I think they're very gifted, and there are other people who, you know, they're poets. For example, Sharon Olds is a very influential poet, and she does something that, you know, I don't want to do, but I think that she does what she does very well, and she's, I can assure you, a lot more influential than I am, you know, because I'm writing this weird stuff, you know, Man and Camel, you know. What am I eating for breakfast? Yeah. I can't hear you.
You in Chicago, you work poetry and social thought.
Oh, I don't work I'm in the Committee on Social Thought, which is a very small elite graduate program. Where it's a PhD program where you have to satisfy requirements ancient to modern in history, philosophy, and literature. And so it's very interdisciplinary, and I teach Dante or Shakespeare or Kafka or Wallace Stevens or Emily Dickinson or Whitman, people like that. I mean, I do teach as much poetry as I can. But I, you know, I don't teach writing. I did at one time, but I sort of ran out of gas in that department. But I like teaching great books. And whether that's, I mean, social thought is a misnomer, really. It was a way that the social sciences could hire people that the, say, English department really didn't want. This is years ago. You know, sort of kind of wilder types. We consider ourselves amateurs, you know. John Coetzee teaches there too. He's always a novelist and a poet, and a lot of philosophers, and Robert Pippin and Jonathan Lear, who's, you know, writes on Aristotle and Freud. You know, it's an interesting mix of people, and we all take each other's classes. It's fun. You have professors in your class. Make you prepare a little harder when your colleagues are showing up, you know.
Perhaps one more question.
Oh, yeah, well, two more, because I saw two hands go up at once, yeah.
What drives you or inspires you to write the way you do?
I don't know. I mean, I don't... I mean, I know I'm inspired to write because I enjoy writing, although it's frustrating and it depresses me sometimes, but by and large I enjoy it. But why I write what I write, I don't know. I mean, and I don't want to know. As long as it keeps coming. Yeah, somebody here? Who?
Just going to respond to your
yeah. An hourglass. What significance do modern icons, or perhaps traditional icons, hold for you and perhaps for your audience?
Well, not much. I mean, clearly that's a figure for time, Father Time. I just took Father Time and turned him into the figure of death. In most cultures, death is a woman, you know. But modern icon, I mean, I don't deal in that, really.
Was that more of a playful analogy, then?
Yeah, I mean, the poems are sort of... The poems are an odd mix of the humorous... And it's dark humor. It's called black humor. I don't worry about things like that. The problem in the poem was to walk that thin line between the humorous and the dark. And the figure of death I'm just going to turn Father Time into Mr. Death. I mean, that was as simple as that. Okay. Well, there's one more there. I'll answer it fast.
Okay. Sure.
Thank you. You read a poem, The Elegy of Prince.
Yeah. Well, Brodsky and I met in New York when he first came to this country, and I'd sent him New Year's cards for a couple of years. I'm never sure whether he got them because I never heard from him. And when I met him, I said, "You ever get my cards?" He said, "Oh yeah, thank you." He said, "I read D'Arcy," and I was floored. He said, "And your poem," he quoted a long poem of mine, and then I practically fell on my knees, kissed his hand, kissed the cuff of his pants, you know. And so we became friends, and we hung out together. We would meet in Rome, say, or I would go to Michigan to visit him. We meet in New York a lot. That was just, that's about it. We just hung out. Okay, thanks.